Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2, for the record, program number 744, The Shape of Things to Come. This is being recorded on June 5th of the year 2011. We're going to plunge right in where we left off in Side 1, that is, with a September 4th, 2009 Wall Street Journal article by Shobhan Gorman. It's called How Team of Geeks Cracked Spy Trade. It talks about Palantir, the electronic intelligence service that was co-founded, basically underwritten by Peter Thiel, who's underwriting the Seasteading Institute and who helped underwrite Facebook and was the co-founder of PayPal, a far right winger who thinks that democracy and freedom are incompatible and that America began going downhill when women got the right to vote. That'll give you an idea of where this guy is at and where this whole milieu is at. Palantir is an electronic intelligence firm deeply involved with the national security establishment. Its main cachet, so to speak, is counterterrorism, but there are indications that it may be being used against people who are simply politically opposed to the agendas of the Koch brothers and some of the people who are involved with the Seasteading Institute, Palantir, and others. Note, as we looked at in For the Record 718, we won't have time to go into them here, but note the very possible connections of Peter Thiel to the underground Reich and the Bormann Capital Network. Alexander Karp may very well have the same kinds of connections. Returning to the September 4th, 2009 Wall Street Journal article about Palantir. Technology like Palantir's is increasingly important to spies confronting an information explosion where terrorists can hide communications in vast data streams on the Internet. Intelligence agencies are struggling to identify and monitor such information and quickly send relevant data to the analysts who need it. U.S. officials say the software is also crucial as the country steps up its offensive in difficult theaters like Afghanistan. There, Palantir's software is now being used to analyze constantly shifting tribal dynamics and distinguish potential allies from enemies, according to current and former counterterrorism officials familiar with the work. It's a new way of warfighting, says former Assistant Secretary of Defense Mary Beth Long. While there are many good systems, Ms. Long says, with Palantir's software, quote, you can actually point to examples where it was pretty clear that lives were saved, unquote. Palantir's chief rivals are 12 Inc., a 20-year-old software company with offices in McLean, Virginia, and a handful of defense contractors who have been building software for intelligence agencies for years. 12's general manager, Todd Drake, dismisses his upstart competitor as, quote, the new sexy thing, unquote, saying that Palantir won't be able to make lasting inroads in a government market that prizes the stability of established companies. Palantir's CEO, Mr. Karp, says such criticism doesn't trouble him. He says the company is already expanding rapidly. And listen to the background here of Palantir and Karp. Palantir's roots date back to 2000 when Mr. Karp returned to the U.S. after living for years in Frankfurt, Germany, where he earned his doctorate in German social philosophy and discovered a talent for investing. He reconnected with a buddy from Stanford Law School, Peter Thiel, the billionaire founder of online payment company PayPal. By the way, Peter Thiel's roots also go to Frankfurt, Germany, as we looked at in 718. Continuing. In 2003, Mr. Thiel pitched an idea to Mr. Karp. Could they build software that would uncover terror networks using the approach PayPal has devised to fight Russian cyber criminals? PayPal's software could make connections between fraudulent payments that on the surface seemed unrelated. By following such leads, PayPal was able to identify suspect customers and uncover cyber crime networks. The company saw a tenfold decrease in fraud losses after it launched the software, while many competitors struggled to beat back cheaters. Mr. Thiel wanted to design software to tackle terrorism because at the time, he says, the government's response to issues like airport security was increasingly nightmarish, unquote. The two launched Palantir in 2004 with three other investors, but they attracted little interest from venture capital firms. The company's $30 million startup costs were largely bankrolled by Mr. Thiel and his own venture capital fund. They modeled Palantir's culture on Google's with catered meals of ahi tuna and a free-form 24-hour workplace wired so 16 people can play the Halo video game. The kitchen is stocked by request with such items as Pepto-Bismol and glass bottles of Mexican Coca-Cola sweetened with sugar instead of corn syrup. The company recently hosted its own Battle of the Bands. One of the venture firms that rejected Palantir's overtures steered the company to InQtel, a nonprofit venture capital firm established by the CIA a decade ago to tap innovation that could be used for intelligence work. As Silicon Valley's venture funding dries up, InQtel says it has seen a surge of requests from startups in the last year or so, many of which now see the government as an alternate money stream. InQtel invested about $2 million in Palantir and provided a critical entree to the CIA and other intelligence agencies. For his first spy meeting in 2005, Mr. Karp shed his tracksuit for a sports coat. He arrived at an agency, he won't say which one, and it was immediately freaked out, unquote, by security officers guarding the building with guns. In a windowless, code-locked room, he introduced himself to the first official he met. "Hi, I'm Alex Karp," Mr. Karp said, offering his hand. No response. "I didn't know you really don't ask their names," he says now. Mr. Karp showed the group a prototype. The software was similar to PayPal's fraud detection system, but instead of identifying and connecting cybercriminals, it focused on two hypothetical terror suspects and followed their activities, including travel and money transfers. After the demo, he was peppered with skeptical questions. "Is anyone at your company cleared to work with classified information? Have you ever worked with intelligence agencies? Do you have senior advisors who have worked with intelligence agencies? Do you have a sales force that is cleared to work with classified information?" The answer every time was no. But the group was sufficiently intrigued by the demo, and InQtel arranged for Palantir engineers to meet directly with intelligence analysts to help build a comprehensive search tool from scratch. Every other week, for about 2 years, the engineers returned to Washington with a revised product based on analyst requests. The approach won over a number of tech-savvy younger analysts who asked their bosses to adopt the software. Spy agencies like the CIA and military intelligence organizations have hundreds of databases each, most of which aren't linked up. And it goes on to describe how Palantir basically helps to do that. I would note that Palantir, if it happened to be hooked up to an entity, say, like the Underground Reich, which might want to data mine some of these intelligence services, just might be able to do so. The thing that I find disturbing about a fellow like Peter Thiel having as much to do with Palantir, which may have Underground Reich roots, Borman Capital Network roots, and that is that the organization has, according to research done by Think Progress, been involved in a project with other contractors to work on behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce against its enemies, including people, labor unions, and others who are opposed to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce agenda. John Donahue, the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, is a fierce political opponent of Barack Obama. The following is from the thinkprogress.org website of March 19th of 2011. It's called Chamber Leaks, Military Contractors Palantir and Barrico Under Scrutiny. Last month, Think Progress revealed a campaign organized by lawyers for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce against its opponents by using three security contractors, Palantir Technologies, Barrico Technologies, and HB Gary Federal. During an Armed Services Committee hearing on Wednesday, Representative Hank Johnson, Democrat of Georgia, asked military officials to provide contract information related to the government's business with the firms involved in the chamber proposal. Chairman Representative Mac Thornberry, Republican of Texas, requested that the information be made available to the full subcommittee. Palantir, Barrico, and H.B. Gary may have used techniques and technologies developed under military contracts in their pro-chamber campaign. For months, the security firms, who named their collaboration Themis, after the Roman goddess of law and order, worked on behalf of the chamber's law firm, Hunton & Williams, LLP, creating electronic dossiers on political opponents of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce through illicit means. So, Palantir may be using, ultimately, U.S. tax dollars, of which they were the recipients to an extent, although most of the money came from, at least initially, came from Peter Thiel, to spy on civilians who may be opposed to the agenda of not only the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but perhaps the agenda of people like Peter Thiel and Patry Friedman. Patry Friedman seeking to find a workable dictatorship. They're not the only ones. Patry Friedman isn't the only one working to find a workable dictatorship. Rachel Maddow, the television commentator, helped to expose a program that has been put on the books by the Republican governor of Michigan, Rick Snyder. And this basically dovetails with some of the doctrine that has ultimately led to the imposition of Milton Friedman's economic theories around the world. This is from politicsusa.com. It's an article from March 9th of 2011 by Sarah Jones. Headline, Rachel Maddow exposes Michigan Republicans' secret war on democracy. It reads in part, skipping down, Maddow described the threat to democracy in Michigan. Quote, Governor Rick Snyder's budget in Michigan is expected to cut aid to cities and towns so much that a lot of cities and towns in Michigan are expected to be in dire financial straits. Right now, Governor Snyder is pushing a bill that would give himself, Governor Snyder, and his administration the power to declare any town or school district to be in a financial emergency. If a town was declared by the governor and his administration to be in a financial emergency, they would get to put somebody in charge of that town, and they want to give that emergency manager that they just put in charge of the town the power to, quote, reject, modify, or terminate any contracts that the town may have entered into, including any collective bargaining agreements, unquote. The bill also has the power to suspend or dismiss elected officials, quote, this emergency person also gets the power under the bill to suspend or dismiss elected officials. Think about that for a second. Doesn't matter who you voted for in Michigan, doesn't matter who you elected, your elected local government can be dismissed at will. The emergency person sent in by the Rick Snyder administration could recommend that a school district be absorbed into another school district. That emergency person is also granted power specifically to disincorporate or dissolve entire city governments, unquote. Maddow said Michigan Republicans want to abolish entire towns, quote, what year was your town founded? Does it say so, like on the town border as you drive into town? Does it say what year your town was founded? What did your town's founding fathers and founding mothers have to go through to incorporate your town? Republicans in Michigan want to be able to unilaterally abolish your town and disincorporate it. Regardless of what you, as resident of that town, think about it, you don't even have the right to express an opinion about it through your locally elected officials who represent you, because the Republicans in Michigan say they reserve the right to dismiss your measly elected officials and to do what they want instead because they know best, unquote. What's worse is that this power to abolish federal governments could be handed to corporations. Quote, the version of this bill that passed the Republican-controlled Michigan House said it was fine for this emergency power to declare a fiscal emergency invoking all of these extreme powers. It was fine for that power to be held by a corporation. So swaths of Michigan could be at the governor's disposal to be handed over to the discretion of a company. Bear in mind, interjecting, Mussolini called his fascist system the corporate state. Continuing, you still want your town to exist? Take that up with this board of directors of this corporation that will be overseeing your future now. Or rather, don't take it up with them. Frankly, they are not interested, unquote. Maddow talked about the power grab behind the fabrication of a fiscal emergency. Quote, the power to overrule and suspend elected government justified by a financial emergency. Oh, and how do you know you're in a financial emergency? Because the governor tells you you're in a financial emergency, or a company he hires to do so does that instead. The Senate version of the bill in Michigan says it has to be humans declaring your fiscal emergency. The House bill says a firm can do that just as well, unquote. Rachel Maddow concluded, this is about a lot of things. This is not about a budget. This is using or fabricating crisis to push for an agenda you'd never be able to sell under normal circumstances, and so you have to convince everyone that these are not normal circumstances. These are desperate circumstances, and your desperate measures are there or somehow required. What this is has a name. It is called shock doctrine, parenthetically, or the corporate state, or fascism, as Mussolini called it. I would also note, for the record, 412, done in June of 2003, called "The Engineer Intends to Wreck the Train." This creation of a global financial crisis, which may soon be followed by another even more severe global crisis, was deliberately intended. And this shock doctrine was what was intended. Now we're going to go into the shock doctrine. That was a book that was authored by Naomi Klein, who talks about using free market principles of Milton Friedman and instituting those in response to these crises. Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, implies that man-made crises are used to push the free market principles of Milton Friedman et al., which are pushed through while the citizens are reacting to disasters or upheavals. The perpetrators of the shock doctrine require a violent destruction of the existing economic order in order to achieve their means. In the case of the Michigan governor, Snyder positioned himself in a state already reeling from financial crisis, vulnerable and ripe for a takeover. This is very interesting indeed. I would also note that Patry Friedman, Milton Friedman's grandson, is the fellow who's heading up the Seasteading Institute, and he is a fellow who is, well, let's just say that they may be offshore while the rest of us are getting this shock doctrine. Patry Friedman, grandson of Milton Friedman, looking to find a workable dictatorship. Apparently Rick Snyder and the Republicans in Michigan are looking to do the same thing. Sort of a global concept of the same, taking over a city and using it as a corporate entity or incorporating it as a corporate entity, is something that has been implemented as part of the charter city movement. The Quest for a Charter City is an article by David Wessel of the Wall Street Journal. In an article on February 3rd of 2011, he wrote, "For the past couple of years, economist Paul Romer has been hopscotching the globe looking for a country desperate enough to try his audacious notion. Start a new charter city, an enclave free of old laws and practices as William Penn did in Pennsylvania," skipping down. "He thinks he's found the perfect place to build a city that could be as prosperous as Hong Kong or China's Shenzhen, Honduras. About the size of Tennessee with one-tenth the per capita income, Honduras is a country of 7.5 million, a growing number of whom are leaving for the U.S. Its international standing was marred by a messy 2009 expulsion of its elected president. Its murder rate is rising as it becomes a way station for drug traffic. But here's the key. Honduras is interested. 2 weeks ago, with only one no, unquote, its Congress voted to amend the Constitution to allow for a Ciudad Modelo. This is a country in which most people want to pursue the American dream," said Octavia Sanchez Barrientos, chief of staff to Honduran President Porfirio Lobo. Quote, "And they have to leave the country and move to the U.S. to do it. This offers the possibility in the long run that they'll have the opportunity here," unquote. Mr. Romer, now perched at New York University, made his mark 20 years ago arguing that ideas, or recipes as he calls them, are more important to growth than other economists believed. It sounds simple, but it's the stuff of the Nobel Prize. About a decade ago, he walked away from academia, started an online teaching company, sold it, and then turned to his next big idea: to create jobs to lift millions out of poverty, take an uninhabited 1,000-square-kilometer tract, or 386 square miles about the size of Hong Kong, preferably government-owned, write a charter, the all-important rules, allow anyone to move in or out, sounds like the seasteading, doesn't it, invite foreign investors to build infrastructure for profit, and sign a treaty with a well-governed country, say Norway or Canada, to serve as guarantor, to assure investors and residents that the charter will be respected, much as the British once did for Hong Kong, and with some oversight from the Honduran Congress, govern the city. It's a mixture of great creativity and great naivete, says William Esterly, an NYU development economist. He doubts the city, especially if successful, could withstand pressure if the Honduran government turned hostile. Adds Harvard's Ricardo Hausman, quote, "It would be great if it happened so we can take a look at the experiment." He, too, however, has doubts and recalls Henry Ford's failed Fordlandia, which was to be an oasis of U.S. capitalism in Brazil. By the way, Henry Ford, one of Hitler's earliest and most prominent financial backers, and also a prominent backer of American fascist groups as well. Continuing, while Mr. Romer was courting Africans, a group of Hondurans was pondering how to improve their country's prospects. One idea, a turbocharged version of existing free trade zones, was to lure investors to a super embassy, an area governed by another country's laws. Then they spotted an online video of a Romer presentation to a conference. Quote, "As soon as we watched it," said Xavier Arguello, "we knew this is what we were talking about." Again, charter cities, sort of corporate cities in foreign government, in foreign countries, basically little entities of corporatism to be placed as self-governing entities within countries around the world. Perhaps we'll see those in Michigan. Who knows? One of the interesting things that is taking place on the investment front, so to speak, and that concerns the hedge fund managers' desire to go back to the land. Now, this does not mean that hedge fund managers are turning hippie, so to speak, and raising the cry of returning to tilling the earth in order to get back to basics and get in sync with Mother Earth and the rhythms of nature, blah, 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 blah. No, what they see, the hedge fund managers are investing in arable land because they foresee an apocalyptic economic collapse that is going to be characterized by resource wars as well as a brutal struggle for food. And they are basically investing in farmland in order to rake up all of the arable land to profit from this disaster. This is an article from the New York Observer called Hedge Farm, The Doomsday Food Price Scenario Turning Hedgies into Survivalists. It's by Foster Kramer from the New York Observer of May 17th of 2011. On the rare occasion that New Yorkers talk about farming, it's usually something along the lines of what sort of organic kale to plant in the vanity garden at the second house in the Adirondacks. But on a recent afternoon, the Observer had a conversation of a very different sort about agricultural pursuits with a hedge fund manager he'd met at one of the many dark-paneled private clubs in Midtown Manhattan a few weeks prior. Quote, "A friend of mine is actually the largest owner of agricultural land in Uruguay," said the hedge fund manager. "He's a year older than I am. We are somewhere around the 15th largest farmers in America right now. We, as in his hedge fund." It may seem a little odd that in 2011 anyone's thinking of putting money into assets that would have seemed attractive in 1911, but there's something in the air, namely fear. The hedge fund manager and others like him envision a doomsday scenario catalyzed by a weak dollar, higher than you think inflation, and an uncertain political climate here and abroad. The pattern began to emerge sometime in 2008. "The hedge fund manager who bought a farm," read the headline on 1 February 2008, Times of London piece, detailing a British hedge fund manager's attempt to play off the rising prices of grains in order to usurp local farmland. A Financial Times piece 2 months later began, quote, "Hedge funds and investment banks are swapping their Gucci for gumboots," unquote. It detailed BlackRock's then relatively new $420 million agricultural fund, which had already swept up 2,800 acres of land. Even Michael Burry, the now-defunct Scion Capital founder and star protagonist of Michael Lewis's The Big Short, who bet against the housing bubble in 2008 with credit default swaps to enormous profit, gave a rare interview on Bloomberg TV last year explaining that he's thrown his hat into, quote, "productive agricultural land with water on site," unquote, as it's going to be, again quoting, "very valuable in the future," unquote. Like most of those asked to comment for this story to The Observer, Burry declined to discuss his investments in farmland. 3 years later, the purchase of farmland both in America and abroad by outside investors had increased so much that in February, Thomas Hoenig, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, warned against the violent possibilities of a farmland bubble, telling the Senate's Agricultural Committee that, quote, distortions in financial markets, unquote, will catch the U.S. by surprise again. He would know because he's seeing it in his backyard. Kansas and Nebraska reported farmland prices 20% above the previous year's levels and are on pace to double values in 4 years. A study commissioned by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and released in January estimated the amount of private capital currently committed to farmland and agricultural infrastructure at $14 billion. It also estimated that future investments will dwarf what's currently being thrown into land by two or three times. Further down, the study makes a conservative projection that the amount of capital potentially entering the sector over the next decade will fly past $150 billion. I would note in this regard a couple of things. The United Nations has forecast that disruptions in climate change basically is going to produce enormous food shortages around the world. I would also note that Mark Rich's firm, that's Mark Rich of BCCI fame and Mark Rich of covert ops fame, we haven't spoken about him recently, but he has more connections than a switchboard. A firm that he heads has just gone public, and it is deeply involved. It has basically cornered a lot of the market in the speculation on food commodities. Last year, we're going to take a look at Deutsche Telekom's spying on people using T-Mobile. Deutsche Telekom is the German telecommunications company, 72% owned by the German government. It recently purchased T-Mobile from AT&T, or basically, excuse me, it recently sold T-Mobile to AT&T. In exchange, it got a 5.5% ownership of AT&T, and one wonders whether that's going to give Deutsche Telekom, basically the German government, access to AT&T's database, enormously useful for espionage purposes. So consider the following. This in the New York Times of March 26th of 2011 by Noam Cohen. It's tracking your every move, and you may not even know. In part, it reads, a favorite pastime of Internet users is to share their location. Services like Google Latitude can inform friends when you're nearby. Another, Foursquare, has turned reporting these updates into a game. But as a German Green Party politician, Malte Spitz, recently learned, we are already continually being tracked whether we volunteer to be or not. Cell phone companies do not typically divulge how much information they collect, so Mr. Spitz went to court to find out exactly what his cell phone company, Deutsche Telekom, knew about his whereabouts. The results were astounding. In a six-month period from August 31st of 2009 to February 28th of 2010, Deutsche Telekom had recorded and saved his longitude and latitude coordinates more than 35,000 times. It traced him from a train on the way to Erlangen at the start through to that last night when he was home in Berlin. Again, that company is controlled by the German government, now has 5% ownership in AT&T. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 744, The Shape of Things to Come, being recorded on June 5th of 2011. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.